Brandon. Operation Fortitude. But how amazing is it? Because of the outrage of the internet and the good people of fucking Melbourne, it's been cancelled. Operation Fortitude has been cancelled. It's so wonderful. Operation Fortitude, or as I like to call it, Operation For Fuck's Sake, Tony. Who are you competing with to be the biggest prick? Because you win. Stop it. It's difficult. It's hard. I try to be a proud Australian. It's hard to be proud. Personally, I have to find little things in my life to hold on to be a proud Australian. Recently, one of those things is one of us punched a shark. I know that was a dumb, but didn't it make you fucking proud? You're like, yeah, mate. It makes you proud because one of us did a thing that sounds made up. Did it. If that wasn't on camera, no one would have believed that. Like, I punched a shark. Of course you did. And then you gave a loan a wedgie, did you? Fuck off. Another thing that makes me proud to be in Australia is that, this is true, I love that when I am filling out a form online, that our country is right near the top of the drop down there. Good is it? It's like, what country am I from? Australia. Bang. 0.1 second. I'll get on with my day. What's that? I'm early. Okay. What am I going to do with all this free time I now have? Whatever the fuck I want. Yeah. Suck it, Yemen. Anyone from Yemen? Nah, too busy scrolling. Always late. And I know no matter what, but the thing is, like, I know no matter what we get up to, what horrific things we get up to do in this fucking country, I know that I will always love being Australian, and I know that because I was in the UK, and I was flying back to Melbourne, not on Tiger, because I'm not a fucking idiot. Come on. Tiger Airways, guys. Tiger Airways. If you had an airline, why would you name it after an animal that can't fly and kills people? So, not on Tiger, but I flew back into Melbourne, from Melbourne Airport, and I went up to the customs man with my form, and I gave him the form, and he looked at the form, and he looked at me, and he said, "Welcome home." Look, I don't know if they paid her to say that, but she, I was this close to climbing over the counter, jumping into his arms, and giving him a wristy. I swear. Is there anything greater to hear after 24 hours in the sky than "Welcome home"? I was like, ah! Get it out, son. Get it out, you have earned it. A wristy is a hand job, by the way. In case there's anyone looking at me going, oh, it sounds nice, is it a bracelet? I also love Australians because we're opportunists. Did you know that? And I know that because I did that piece of material on stage once and a gentleman in the front row looked up at me and went, "Welcome home!" Just on the off chance, someone's worth a shot. And I am single, but I'm fine with that. Well, generally, I thought I was fine with that, and then recently I got drunk and I signed myself up for eHarmony, which is a dating website, and I don't remember doing it, and I went back to it the next day. Turns out I am looking for someone who can bring me a pizza. Because I drink alone and I get on the internet and bad things happen. I do drink alone and I know it's not good, you're not supposed to, but I like it a lot. Just like it, I enjoy it. I've been known to leave parties where I'm having a good time and I go, "I've got to go." And they go, "Do you have to get up early?" And I go, "No, no, I just like to continue this without you guys." And dating is the worst. If you're doing it, good for you guys, because it's brutal. Like, this isn't even a joke. This is just technically what dating is, okay? Dating is going up to someone that you don't know and going, "What do you think of this?" And they go, "Nah." You go, "Okay." what do you think of this? And if you just go on dates and they don't go anywhere, you just don't know why. Like, you have no idea what happened. And then you get to go home and play a fun game that I like to call, was it my face or my opinions? And you know what? Could be both. Yahtzee! Like, single people got a couple of shit, but we got some advantages. Like, if you have love, good for you. But single people, we got some stuff. For example, single stories are way better than relationship stories. They are better stories. Like, if you're in a relationship and you think something funny happened to you, it didn't. I'm so sorry. Oh, really? You're in IKEA for how many hours and you picked up the wrong... Excuse me, I'm going to go kill myself. And I tried to stop dating, and no one believes me. If you tell someone I'm not trying to meet, they don't believe. A friend of mine said to me, she goes, Celia, if you're really not trying to meet anyone, then why do you still wear makeup? If you're not trying to meet anyone, then why are you still wearing makeup? I said, are you serious? I'm single. I'm not confident. What are you talking about? If you're not trying to meet anyone, why don't you cover yourself in shit and roll down a hill? Because... And I'm so single, how single are you? I said the singlest sentence that anyone has ever said. I was talking to someone and I said, I'm reading a lot of trilogies at the moment. No, I'm reading a lot of books. I'm reading so many books that I have to group them. I'm reading a lot of three books at the moment. And also, I went to a cat cafe. Now, if you don't know, you're going, cat cafe? Celia, that can't possibly be as sad as that sounds. Sadder. It's sadder. The cat cafe is a real place where people who want to have cats but have a lifestyle that restricts them from doing that go and rent time with other people's cats. It is the most depressing thing I've ever done, and I fucking loved it. I went three times and go, it's the best. And it's, it took me 2 weeks to get into the cat cafe. The cat cafe is very popular, unlike the people going. If you can't picture it, which one would, it's like a strip club with cats. Like, imagine a strip club, but the strippers are cats. That's exactly what it is. Because you pay money, there's so many stuff like, you pay money and you go in and they're around. They just sort of walk around and you look at them and you're not allowed to pick them up. And, you know, you're not sure if they, like, want to be there. And sometimes, if you're lucky, they jump on your lap and put their bum in your face. I resent the fact that we have allocated cats as the lonely person's pet, by the way. It's not fair. Lonely people shouldn't get cats. Cats don't like them and are always leaving. Lonely people should get rabbits, yeah? Because a rabbit is basically a cat with broken legs. It is. A rabbit is a cat that cannot leave you, right? And if you break a rabbit's legs, you get a guinea pig. Which we should eat. Yum. No, we should eat guinea pigs, hear me out. Not because they taste good, I bet they taste terrible. I think we should eat guinea pigs because their quality of life is the worst and they want to die. Have you seen them? A guinea pig is a physical representation of the emotion fear. A guinea pig is what fear looks like. It's what fear is in a 3D physical... Their entire existence is terrified. Even when they're eating and sleeping, they are shitting it. Their natural habitat is a haunted house. So, do you know they don't exist in the wild? We breed them. We breed guinea pigs. If you want a guinea pig, you have to breed a rock, some hair, and that feeling you get when your flatmate creeps into bed with you and you realize you live alone. This is one man with a really really loud laugh, but I've only heard it once, so I'm kind of disappointed. I'm like, ah. I like emotions like fear, because like fear feels bad, but it's useful. Like I like emotions that people always think are bad. Like hate is the obvious one. Like people always think hate's a bad thing. I mean, all the time. Like love can come from hate. For example, I love peanut butter because an ex of mine is allergic to nuts, and every time I eat peanut butter, I imagine him dying. Yum, yum, yum. Oh, his throat would be closing up right about now. Blah, blah, blah. I think nut allergies is going to be the thing that wipes us out as a species, by the way. You know, you're like, oh, it's going to be meteorite, climate change. Well, I think it's going to be nut allergies. Because we weren't allergic to nuts, and now we are. And do you think it's a coincidence that satay is one letter away from Satan? Sometimes I hate stuff just for no reason. Like, I hate jeggings. If you don't know, jeggings are leggings that look like jeans that make you look skinny, except that they aren't and they don't. This is what I'm very excited to tell you this time, Noah. I was hating on a thing though one day that led me to unlock a secret of the universe, right? Now, the thing that I was hating on was toe rings, all right? I hate toe rings more than I should hate toe rings. I think it's because I hate feet. And whenever I see a toe ring, I think what you're doing there is you're taking an already gross toe and you're trying to make it look like a tiny faceless man with a hairy chest wearing a belt. Stop. Gimli. Try to make your toe look Gimli. I hate it. So one day I was generally just sitting in my flat going, I fucking hate toe rings. What is the point of them? Who invented these things? Why do we have them? What is the point of them? What is the point of the toe rings? And then I had an epiphany. So you know toe rings. They're rings that people wear on their toes. And then we have earrings, rings for the ears, eyebrow rings, nose rings, belly button rings. But these ones, rings. Because if these ones were called finger rings, make weddings pretty awkward. With this fingering, I make proposal stories really awkward. Oh my God, so the other night, Tim came over and just out of nowhere, just gave me the most incredible fingering. I know, I'm so happy. I mean, he asked my dad's permission first. And my dad was like, you go for it, son, you give her that fingering. And he came over and he got down on one knee and he said, I want to give you this fingering. It's the same fingering that my grandfather gave to my grandmother. Also make Lord of the Fingerings very different film. Okay. Guys, you are a fucking cracking audience. I'm so excited for you to be here. I'm excited to get to introduce this back. Can we start the clapping in the chair and get your hands up? Thank you.
Yes, Melbourne. Yes, Melbourne. Yes. What is happening in this city? You people have gone fucking insane. All I heard from all my friends was Melbourne, it's so beautiful. I've been here 2 days, Melbourne. 2 days. Yesterday, it seemed, from my eyes, to be a monsoon coming in, plus a city boy panic over a tram strike. All I heard there's no trams! There's no fucking trams! Look out, there's no trams! Society's going to collapse, there's no trams! And I said, well, what's happening? And someone at the hotel said, well, there's a tram strike from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. Melbourne, that's not a strike. You understand that? That's a long lunch. That's barely a pause. And we'll get you to work and we'll get you back from work, but in the middle, you're going to feel our wrath. And now you've just decided to dabble in being Nazis for a while. Let's just see how it feels. Let's just check people's papers just to see how we've never tried it before. We won't do the uniforms yet. That's a commitment. If you find out if you like it, you get some good uniforms made. And you just ask people for their papers and you see how it's gone. So is it, are you doing it tomorrow? No.
No.
No. No. You've decided not to. You just dipped your toe in the Nazi pond and went, that's actually a little spicy. That's pick a fucking lane, Melbourne. Either you're Nazis or not. To his credit, Hitler was a terrible human being. But when he suggested doing awful things and people said, are you sure? He didn't say, you're right, it's a terrible idea. But we've had the clothes, we have to, we've made them first. That's the key mistake is that. Australia and immigration. There's just no room here, is there? There's just... I was so disappointed to get to the airport and not see Barnaby Joyce just frisking people down for dogs. I know you're fucking bringing them. I know you've got a tiny dog. Never again! Not on my watch! That was a spectacular incident for the international community to watch as well. An elected government minister saying, we'll kill your fucking dogs. I will personally rip their heads from their tiny furry shoulders. And I will put each dog's head on my middle finger and I'll send you back to Hollywood, Depp. Your career's a mess, mate. Unbelievable. I had a quintessential Australian welcome as well. We were driving away from the airport into Melbourne, and we drove past that red, the spiky red things with the yellow thing coming across it. Spiky red, long yellow. And I said to the driver, what is this? It's a fair question when you see a spiky red thing with a long yellow. I said, what is that? And he said, I swear this is true, he said, well, there's two ways of answering that question. The first is, it's an abstract piece of art. It's supposed to open your mind as you're driving through, and it becomes a kind of representation of a gateway to Melbourne. And then he just let that hang in the air. We both knew there was the option B coming. We knew that. We knew that was coming, but there was no way he was rushing it. He was taking his sweet time. And so eventually I said, what is the second explanation? He said, well, the other explanation is it's just a fucking zip. I've only been to Australia, this has been a spectacular 48 hours. I've only been to Australia once before. It was like a year and a half ago, and I went to Sydney and to Wagga. That's it. And every time I mention that that's where I went, that's kind of the response of, why? Why did you do that? I told Celia yesterday, and she just looked shocked. And why did you see you then? Kind of made me think you're all very nervous when you hear that outsiders have gone to Wagga. It's interesting, did you see the thing that we've been hiding there? By which I mean the people of Wagga, did you see them? We were shooting on a farm there, I helped this, we finished interviewing the farmer, and he said to me, this really tough, brawny, that's my representation. It's because I don't have the muscle mass to present a strong man to you, so that's... He's a really nice guy, and he said to me, as they were packing away the camera equipment, he said, I've got to get the sheep in, John. Do you want to help me get the sheep in? And I said, yeah. I'd absolutely love to help you get the sheep in. So we rode out with him on like a four-wheeled thing. And we went, and we got in the sheep, and like I was... making them, and it was really good. The sun was going down and they were kicking up dust and I was really enjoying it, thinking, look, this is a tangible thing that I'm doing. They used to be over there and now they're over here, and I had a role in that. And I was kind of as happy as I'd been for a long time, and I really wanted his approval. So I said to him afterwards, what, did I do all right with the sheep? How did I do getting the sheep in there. And he said, again, in a beautifully Australian manner, he said, yeah, you did good job, yeah, you did fine. It is worth remembering that you were still slightly less good than a dog. Okay. I'll try and put my self-esteem back together, shall I? Anyway, it is lovely to be here. It's hard as a British person to travel anywhere on Earth that isn't Britain. Because, you know, you're confronted with the actions of your ancestors, and those are very rarely good actions. It's very hard as a British person to go to anywhere, any airport. If anyone just looks at you angrily, you just have to think, I've not read the history book on that. I'm guessing what we did was absolutely unforgivable, but deep down we'd do it again if we got the opportunity. But Australia, of course, it's even harder because, you know, you're forced to confront the idiocy of your ancestors because it's so beautiful here. You know, fantastic weather, other than yesterday. Now, really incredible food, koalas. You've got everything you need in a land. So that's the hat trick of human happiness. If you have those three things, Australia, as you do, and you're not happy, that's on you. But it's hard with the whole prison colony. It's hard because you're forced to confront the idiocy of English people in the past. Because it hits you, suddenly hits you, hold on. We sent our criminals to somewhere that was objectively nicer than where we lived. But what we clearly should have done is just built an enormous fence around the British coastline and said, you all stay here, we're fucking leaving now. Just imagine how confused that first criminal must have been as he set foot off the prison ship on the coast of Australia and his toes sank into warm sand. The water lapped against his tired ankles. The sun beat down strangely upon his shoulders. In the distance, a kangaroo hopped across the horizon. He must have thought to himself, they are going to kill us now, right? Because no country in human history has ever been this fucking stupid. Just for the record, I've learned the opposite of my lesson from this experience so far. Because the way I break it down is, if you commit a crime and you get caught, sure, it's a long boat ride, but then things really start looking up for you. I only have, for my last time here, I only have one complaint with this country, which is not bad, is it? A single complaint? That's... I know you're expecting more than that. My only complaint is that Australia is the most comfortably racist place I have ever been in my life. Not the most racist. Australia, relax, although you'll get there. Especially if you decide to U-turn on your U-turn with the Border Patrol squads. But you know what it would be? Let's just see if we like it. No, you know, just the most comfortable in your racism. You've already settled into your bigotry here, like an old, friendly, suspicious slipper. Because everywhere I went in Australia last time, from Sydney to Wagga and back to Sydney, I started hearing the same confusing thing. I couldn't understand people saying, what, glad you like it, you don't? Yeah, that's how you sound to me. Glad you like it, yeah. Glad you're here in an honest hall. Here in Shire. It's a beautiful place. Too many lebos, obviously, but otherwise we've got a fantastic country on our hands here. You're way too many lebos, John, truth be told, got way too many lebos here, lebos there. Look here, John, there's bloody lebos everywhere. And eventually, I had to physically stop someone and go, I need to ask you something, and I know you're going to think me a fool for asking it. But what is a lebo? And they looked at me like I was clinically insane and said, Lebanese people? And you have to understand, My response to that was, who the fuck has a problem with Lebanese people, Australia? I'll give you this, that is undeniably specific. You have laser-focused your bigotry. That's why I say, you know who I hate? Sri Lankans. Malaysians, lovely people. Bangladeshis, the best. But Sri Lankans, fuck them. They know what they did. And just a quick mathematical question, Australia. How many Lebanese people can there be here to necessitate there being a perceived national problem? Bear in mind, there are only 4 million Lebanese people in fucking Lebanon! Just pump the brakes! And I know that's what your Border Patrol squad are looking for. Bloody people. I'm angry and I can't articulate why. I've always loved Australian politics, particularly now as well, because of the gift you've inexplicably decided to give yourselves and the world. Thank you, it's great. From the outside, we don't have to live with him. But it's, I can't quite, what's the long-term plan with Tony Abbott? What's your long-term goal with that guy? Because it seems to me like he's a kind of installation art piece that you set up. Just to pose the question to people, what would it be like if a major international country were to elect a man like this? What would we do? It's worth thinking about, isn't it? And that's what Tony's here to ask you. What's that? Seems, not sure. I'm hoping that refers to Tony Abbott and that's not some more Lebo racism coming out. I'm guessing it's an Abbott thing, and also you have elevated heckles early on here, Australia. Not the standard heckles for you, I'll give you a single word and I'll let you look into what I think. Taxidermy, let that rattle around your head. It's great, there are very few countries on earth where you could just happily let people get away with saying, we're going to stuff the leader of our country. Because just for the record, no one in this room, there was no sense of pushing back against what he suggested. It's an option. It's a, that is. I'm not saying we're going to do it. I'm saying it's an option. Does he know that you feel about it? Does he know? I like to think that he's somewhere and he's suddenly, his ears are pricked up. I think someone might have just suggested that I was stuffed and mounted to a wall. To a room full of people generally conceding the point. Yes. One of the things that's fascinated me so much about Australian democracy is that you have that very rare thing in democratic countries around the world, which is you have 100% voting. Yeah, I don't think maybe you don't even know how rare that is. Compulsory voting is that's a fair reflection of how people feel about that. Yeah, great, we're made to do it, and look what we do. We can't be trusted with voting, it's like giving a child a tambourine. It is an interesting idea, kind of forcing people to vote. The problem, I was reading about this a while ago, that it seems that you've run into from this, I can't remember if it was the Herald or the Age, this article from a while ago, saying that people, too many people now have started voting drunk. Because you vote on a weekend, right? To give everyone a chance to go, and is it a national holiday? No, it's not. So you just put it on a weekend, and if people have to work, you think, well, I guess you're a criminal. The interesting thing about it is, so many people started voting drunk that they had, after the last election, they did a study, and they found out voting drunk affects your ability to vote by 18%. Which I think has to be a guess. Because I like to think, Australia, when I've been really drunk in my life, when I have truly let myself down, that would affect my ability to vote by, and this is just a ballpark figure, but it would affect it by around 100%. And then it removes my ability to walk, think, and grip anything. And yet this same study found out voting drunk actually makes you more right-wing. Which I did not see coming. Because it's against your popular understanding of the drunk person. In a way, isn't it? I love you! I bloody love you! But I cannot justify continued expenditure on the welfare state. I can't do it. You're removing the incentive to work. It's Tony again. It's Tony. He'll sort us out before he's snuffed. Well, thank you so much for having me here in the country before I am forcibly ejected. And thanks for such a warm welcome this evening. It could have been warmer. And let me tell you, let me tell you exactly what I was looking for. Because for the first time in my life a while ago, I got a puppy. And I love my puppy more than I have the ability to express to you. I'm too British, that's a strong emotion. So I don't really, what I do with the strong emotion is I repress it and I'll never address it. But I really love her, and I had to leave her for a couple of weeks a while ago, not on her own, relax. I didn't say there's food in the fridge, learn to survive. This is a huge moment for you in the animal kingdom. But I was really worried that when I got back home, she wouldn't recognize me. And I was even more concerned about how I might react if that were to happen. So I got back and I put my key in the door of my flat. And I was thinking to myself, don't do this to me, little dog. Do not hurt me in a way you do not understand you have the capacity to. And I opened the door and she was sitting on the couch at the end of the corridor and she just froze. She didn't move. And I thought, oh no, you've just broken my heart. And now I'm going to need to get a new dog. But then she cocked her head to the side, ran as fast as she could down the corridor towards me, frantically wagging her tail, sat down on the front of my feet, and just wet herself. And it hit me in that moment, no one has ever been that happy to see me than that dog was in that moment ever. Once, Australia, just once, I'd like to walk up to a stage and have an audience collectively, spontaneously urinate all over themselves. At least that way I know that you meant it. I witnessed a miracle as well before I came out here, and I wanted to tell you about it. I was at this airport in Jersey. A terrible airport in a terrible state in America, and there were way too, it was a horrible atmosphere in the departure gate. There's way too many people in the gate and area, and everyone was crammed in. They were really furious with each other and themselves for being in this position. And I was doing what everyone else was doing, which was like just staring at the floor to try and avoid humanity a little worse. And then just in front of my feet, out of nowhere, a pigeon walked across the floor in front of me. Somehow a pigeon had got inside the departure gate and was just walking around. Not flying. At no point did it fly. Just happily pigeon walking its way around the airport. Not just walking, walking with complete confidence. So confident it was forcing other people to look out of the way first. Just, thank you. So confident, I would not have been that surprised if it actually walked over to a departure desk and said, any news on the 440 to Cleveland? Delayed again. That is fucking bullshit. Why do I do this to myself? I can fly. This makes no sense. But then the miracle happened. Because out of nowhere, I was looking down at the pigeon and I was smiling to myself. And I looked up and there were other people watching it and smiling as well. And they were filming it on their cell phones and texting the footage to anyone they loved so they could enjoy it too. And people started talking to strangers saying, have you seen the pigeon? There's an inside pigeon. Make sure you see the inside pigeon. There's an inside, it's walking, it's not flying. There's an inside pigeon walking around. You make sure you see it before you leave, which, by the way, you're probably not going to. But make sure you see it before you don't leave. And all of a sudden, the atmosphere had shifted. It used to be like aggressive and hostile. And now it was warm and welcoming and joyful. And I thought, is this how close we are to everything being fundamentally okay? A pigeon being somewhere a pigeon is not normally expected to be. Have we always been that tantalizingly close to solving the world's toughest problems? It's got to be worth a go. Next time there's a Middle East peace summit at the UN, let's get Netanyahu and Abbas in a room, shove a pigeon in there, close the door behind it, and have it just wander around the table. Say, oi oi. Guess who's somewhere they're not supposed to be? It's got to be a two-state solution, chaps, doesn't it? Seems like the only practical path forward at this point. But let's save that for later, because which one of you two wants to see me peck a Dorito? Which one of you like that? Exactly, you both did, that's my point. You're not that different. Pigeon out. Pigeon out. Be worth a go. Give a little pigeon, an indoor pigeon, to Tony. See if we can avoid stuffing him in the future. It'd be nice. It's nice to be here as well, because the only gigs I've been able to do recently because of work have been charity gigs, and charity gigs are terrible. Not the charities themselves. Those are great. Charities are great. I can't believe I've backed myself into a corner where I've actually had to say that word. Charities are fine. Now, the problem for a charity gig to be worth anything, you need to make the most money you possibly can for that charity. And to do that, you need to get the richest people in any area into a room and milk them for money. Which is fine. The problem is, the richest people in any area are often the worst people in that area. And I did a gig in New York for something called the Robin Hood Foundation. And it's a great anti-poverty organization in New York. The problem is, the richest people in New York are some of the richest and worst people on the entire planet. And if they are the solution for poverty, they're at least partially the fucking cause of it as well. And I saw $60 million raised in that room. 60 million from just bankers, just old white men going, where? 3 million, take it from me. I've already forgotten I've given it to you. I've probably made more than that in the time it's taken for me to finish this thought. The only reason my arm is still in the air is that I employ someone to take my arm down for me whenever I raise it. And he has singly failed to do that. Oh, here he is. Thank you, Malcolm. Here's $4. I'm a job creator. The problem is, the more money was getting raised in that room, the angrier and angrier I was getting. And also, comedy doesn't work in a room of people with that amount of money. Because if you're that rich, you don't need comedy. There's really no point in laughter. There's no tension in your life that needs to be diffused with anything. Everything is a fixable problem. You can't even write jokes to appeal to them. You can't say, oh, you know what it's like when your yacht needs cleaning. Because they'll just say, well, you have it cleaned. What a strange question. You don't clean it yourself, you pay for someone to have
It cleans, and you pay them as little as you like. They're probably desperate. That is quite funny, but that wasn't the joke you were making, was it?
And I was getting so angry about what was happening, about generosity. I was getting so angry about it. And the person who was about to go on after me was this American football player, a huge guy called Michael Strahan. I'd never met him before. I was getting really tense and mad. I turned around to him and I said, "Michael, fuck these people." And he just hugged me and just held me. And it was like time froze. Because I realised I'd never felt safer in my entire life. It was all I could do to not obey my body's instincts and just jump up into his arms and say, "Just hold me close, Michael. Let me put my ear on your big chest and listen to your heartbeat and know that everything's going to be okay." But the most emasculating thing was I could feel him being delicate with me. His arms had already gone too far around. And he was not squeezing. I could feel him not squeezing in case I broke somehow. I've always felt very awkward around athletes because that's all I ever wanted to be. Fuck you! Fuck you! Don't use laughter as a weapon, that's mean. He wanted to be an athlete. Does he think chess is a registered sport? I did. All I wanted was to be a professional football player and play for Liverpool. That's it. That's all I wanted. I say that like it wasn't that big an ask. That was my dream. From a little kid, that's all I wanted. And it's odd that I can tell the exact moment when my dream was completely killed in front of me. And it's odd to have a precise moment, like a second, where your life is going in your mind in one way, and then a second happens, and it is forced to redirect. And what happened was, I was about 15 years old, and I used to play for our school team. And it was half time of a game, and we were losing, but I thought I was playing quite well. And that might show what a tremendous teammate I was. Well, this is definitely not my fault, is it, chaps? And our coach came in and he was furious. And I think he threw something at the wall and he said, "You should be ashamed of yourselves. You should all be ashamed of yourselves. Why can't you look at Oliver?" And I thought, yes, why can't they look at me? And I thought, this is a speech that I'm going to remember for the rest of my life. This is when I win the World Cup one day and they say, "Was there a moment?" I'll say, "Let me stop you, there was, and I'll tell you what it was." But the very fact I'm here shows it didn't work out that way. He said, "Look at Oliver. He knows he's shit, but he runs around more than any of you." I distinctly remember the sensation of going, "Oh, I did not know that though." I didn't know it. And I feel there's a consensus in the room of that was a fact that I honestly, genuinely didn't know that. And it would have been useful if someone had pointed that out. I feel like I've wasted at least half a decade thinking about this. And then I got to meet my heroes last year in the worst way. Liverpool, they did a pre-season game in New York, and I went to see them. It was really exciting just to see them in the flesh. My heroes, thinking, there they are, running around, this is fantastic. And it was really fun. And then someone after the game from the Liverpool front office said, "Do you want to come down to the dressing room and meet the players?" And I, in my defense, I said, "No, that's not a good idea, because I don't think you understand how much I love these men. That's not an encounter that can possibly go well." But she said, "Oh, don't be ridiculous." She just started pulling me, and so we went down into the basement of the stadium, and we were walking on the corridor, and I could see the entrance to the dressing room, and coming in the other direction, also being brought down to meet the players, was Daniel Craig. James fucking Bond! I was about to meet my childhood heroes with James fucking Bond.
So I'll let Bond go in first. Obviously, you let Bond in first. Because if there's any danger inside, he can neutralize that danger quickly. So I walk in closely behind him, desperately trying not to hum to myself. Ding, 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 ding. I'm here with James Bond. And we walked into the dressing room, and there was no one in there. It was just deserted, but there was lots of steam in the room. And there was this sound of fast running water from the adjacent room. And then that water suddenly stopped. And I thought, oh no. We have picked the single worst moment to come down here. But before I could even finish that thought, through the steam came the entire Liverpool scene, completely naked. Somehow, in my mind, in slow motion. I don't know how, but just there they came, emerging through the steam, waving a handsless hello to us. And to his credit, Bond handled the situation magnificently. He went straight over, maintained nothing but disciplined eye contact, going, nice to meet you, nice to meet you, I'm Daniel, yeah, Bond, nice to meet you. And I hung back thinking that I definitely can't do that. That is not a club in my bag in terms of social etiquette. I knew if I walked over there, the only thing that was going to happen, I was going to go, and he's gone. And he's gone. I thought, I won't do that. Instead, I'll just sit or lean against the wall and I'll just watch them. Yeah, you're right, my plan B wasn't significantly better. So I just watched them drying themselves. Until Steven Gerrard, my favourite player, a man who my dad wrote to, like, he's never written a letter to me in my life, and he wrote Steven Gerrard a letter just to thank him for being himself. I saw Steve Gerrard beckon over a security guard and point at me as if to say, who's that creepy guy watching me dry my balls? Can he maybe not be here immediately? And I was escorted out by security, thinking to myself, I knew it was going to go like this. Never meet your heroes. What's that? I'm afraid there were no consonants in that head. That was just, all I heard was, That seemed less like a sentence and more like sonar. I'm not sure you were trying to say anything, just judging how close you are to the stage. It's about 40 feet, I think. What was the question?
Was he big and very hard?
Was he big? Are we talking about a lady over trans? Please. Please, please. Don't make that sweet story about. I saw it again. That's the problem. That is the problem. That's why it's fundamentally changed my relationship with half of that team now. Because now I see them on TV and I think, yeah, I remember. Actually, there was the moment, the exact moment, people often ask, when did you know, my dream died then. But I should have got a sense earlier on of what I was more likely to do, because, you know, people often ask, when did you realize you wanted to do comedy? And, no, I don't know, it's hard, isn't it? That's a hard question to answer. I think I knew when it might be an option, and it was actually related to sport as well. I was 11 years old, and there was a sports day at my school, and I was in the 400 metres, and everyone's family and the whole school was watching. And I was there, and on the start line in my white vest and white shorts, and it's not necessarily a funny image. I was a coiled spring waiting to sprint. And, you know, our sports teacher shouted go, and
I ran as fast as I could, and at 100 metres, I realised I was in the lead. And at 200 metres, I was even further in the lead. I remember looking back across to where everyone was crowded watching, thinking, I wonder if you know, my family can see me. I wonder if this is going to be a good memory. And then at 250 metres, I felt this sudden rush of air. The kind of rush of air you normally associate with exiting a shower. Because what had happened was, Melbourne, for reasons that have never been explained to me adequately, the standard issue sports short don't get ahead of it. The standard issue sports short given to British children in the late 1980s came with a slit down the front of it. And what had happened was, Melbourne, my penis had fallen out of my shorts. So even at 11 years old, I realised I was facing a pivotal decision that was likely to affect me for the rest of my life. Did I A, stop running, put my penis back into my shorts, and in all likelihood forfeit the race? Or did I B, continue running like a fucking champion? Of course I went with B. Of course, there was no decision to be made. As I rounded the final bend coming into the home straight, an audible gasp was emitted from the spectators. Let me just remind you, the entire school and everybody's family. And as I put my sprint finish together, my 11-year-old penis started beating out a kind of metronomic rhythm on the inside of each of my thighs, at least proving that technically I was running a sound race. I worry that that detail got lost under the prevailing circumstances. And as I put my final sprint together, that beating motion turned into what can only be described as a kind of swoop. The interesting thing about that is, once you've started that, it's essentially impossible to stop. And I crossed the finish line like a demented helicopter in fourth place. So it was actually probably at that moment I realised being an athlete was not going to be likely for me, but that I might have a career in comedy if I was willing to subject myself to sufficient humiliation. So, oh yeah, hold on. Oh, that's right. I got mistaken. I got sidetracked by thinking about Stephen Gerrard. So the comedy, like, it involved, that was a very embarrassing moment, but everyone laughed and it kind of made everything okay. And comedy's always been there for me at some of the worst moments of my life. All the, whenever it arrives in truly tragic situations, I think sometimes those are the best moments. I remember after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, there was that French state funeral in France, and Luz, who's one of the cartoonists who survived, he said that he was told before the procession started he had to meet Francois Hollande, and he didn't want to do that. He had no real interest in meeting him, whatever had happened. But he felt like he had to, and he could see him walking towards him, and he said out of nowhere a pigeon dropping hit Hollande, like glanced off his head and hit his shoulder, and he laughed and it made him feel better. And I thought, I like the idea that that happened. I like the idea that there was maybe a French pigeon perched on a gargoyle outside Notre Dame going, what can I do? What can I, a mere pigeon? What can I do? I look upon my people, this grief, this mass grief. What can I do? I'm just a pigeon. What can I do? Oh, hold on a second. Why don't I take a shit on the Prime Minister? It's moments like that. One of the most personally alarming moments I had was when I first moved to New York. I didn't know anyone and I was really upset before I left. And my best friend Dan drove me to the airport. He could see that I was really choked up. And he said to me, I bought you this teddy bear. Don't squeeze its tummy.
until you get to your new apartment in New York. So I put it in my bag and I flew to this new apartment. It was a horrible apartment in a horrible area. I felt really lost and alone and like I didn't deserve to be there. And then at the bottom of my bag, I remembered I had the teddy bear, so I picked him up and I gazed into his button eyes and I squeezed him. I'm not ashamed to say that to you, Melvin. I squeezed him in the tummy. And I swear this is true. This is what that bear said back to me. He said, "You will die on your own in a dark, cold room." And I've never loved my friend Dan like I loved him in that moment. Partly because I know where he got that bear and I know how they make them. What happens is you have to record the personalized message into a little plastic box, and then you take that box over to the teddy bear man, who then tests it to check it's working before sewing it into the bear's stomach. So I knew there had to be that moment between my friend Dan and the teddy bear man, as he pressed the button, listened to the message, and then just stared at it. With an instinctive decision to be made. Was this A maverick act of friendship, or was it B, a serial killer? And I know what my friend Dan looks like, and he took a gamble that day. I'm glad he did, but it was a gamble. So I live in America now, and one of the things I like the most about America is it's a much more eccentric place than it gives itself credit for. Well, much more importantly, it's a much more eccentric place than it projects to the rest of the world. Because when you think about America, and when any of us think about America, you think of them as a kind of unified mass of people who, you know, like, cry during the Olympics and chant the initials of their country loudly and often. And you think that they all think the same thing, and of course they don't. America is just like Australia. You're a group of disparate maniacs who fucking hate each other. And that's a good thing. Eccentricity is a much more appealing quality than people being a cohesive bunch. Like, there are many great reasons to come to Australia, but your weirdness is much more appealing than the nice photos of, oh look, it's Bondi Beach. Sure, it's nice. That's a good reason to go. But is it any more reason to go than some of the truly inexplicable things that I found out about here yesterday, such as, and again, you may have forgotten how weird this is, the Harold Holt Memorial Swimming Pool? Someone in the audience last night, I said, "What is the weirdest thing you have here?" And she said, "The Harold Holt Memorial Swimming Pool." And it was like a Rolodex in my head going, "Well, I know that name. Wait, wasn't that Prime Minister who drew, what the fuck?" I mean, that is an incredible thing. To have that, you should be advertising that to the rest of the planet. "Oh, we had a Prime Minister who drowned and we named the swimming pool after him." Why? Because it's fucking funny, that's why. Now that should inspire jealousy in other countries. We don't have the Princess Diana Memorial Racetrack, and frankly, I wish we did! You don't get to be offended, he drowned! Or I believe he disappeared. So there's a chance of one day swim back and go, "Oh, I'm back." What the fuck is that? There are some, well, all the best things I've seen here so far have been completely inexplicable or have been explained but still seem amazing. In fact, you have something called Batman Drive. Sure, I get what he's, I guess it, he's a founder of some, but it's still fucking Batman Drive though, isn't it? These guys were saying to me yesterday, is this true? Or were they bullshitting me? That there was one point where there was a discussion about what to call Melbourne. Is that true?
Yes.
No, you had an option to call this city Batmania. And you thought, nah. I mean, it's a hell of a thing to turn down, isn't it? It's just, you're landing here, your plane lands, and the Qantas pilot comes on and says, "Well, hope you enjoyed your flight, everybody. Welcome to Batmania." It might not be the city you need, but it's the city you deserve. Big mistake. But that is a truly amazing thing. And obviously you have a fantastic Luna Park that at night is the stuff of every child's nightmares. Yes. Charming. What is less terrifying in the world than a wooden roller coaster and at night the entrance of a kind of deathly clown's face? Oh, great, I'll walk through there and I'll never be seen again. If we could have cultural exchanges of countries' eccentricities, it would bind us all together. There are things in America that are really worth seeing, and it's not the stuff they want you to see. Sure, you can go and visit the Washington Monument. It's great. You can go see the Lincoln Memorial. It's fantastic. You can go and see Mount Rushmore if you want. It's fine. It's some people's face on a rock. It's all right. It's a long way to drive to it, and no one's seen it twice. That's all I'm saying. But if you want to see some truly crazy things, America has that, and I wish they advertised it more. There's a place called Boise, Idaho, which has a building in it which is just insane. It's a regular building in many ways, but on the front of it is one word in large yellow letters, and the word is library. And then there is an exclamation mark. And I stood in front of that building for what could have been hours, trying to figure out what that exclamation mark was attempting to say. Was it, "I know, I can't believe Boise's got a library either. This is at best superfluous to this city's requirements." But the amazing thing is, the people of Boise found out that I had been making fun of their building. The reason I know this is that someone forwarded me the link to the letters page of their local newspaper, and there was a letter in there from a furious Boisean woman. And the letter said, "What this idiot does not know and could have found out if he had done the slightest bit of research was that that exclamation mark was donated to the library." By the owner of a local pizza restaurant. I remember reading it thinking, no way. How did you just make this more weird? Because it's weirder now. And I'm obsessed with this image in my mind of the owner of that pizza restaurant marching confidently up to the library like a pigeon in an airport. With two carefully wrapped gifts, one under each arm, one long gift, and one smaller, rounder gift, before placing them on the front desk and saying, "I know two things in my life, pizzas and punctuation. I'm out of here." I think, for the countries that hated America the most, if they could see how insane the people actually are, it could do away with a lot of that hatred straight away. In Minneapolis, they have something called a zombie pub crawl, where 20,000 people, 20,000, dress up in elaborate zombie outfits, and they go from bar to bar, getting dangerously shit-faced. It's frankly something, yeah, I cannot believe. I guess the response in Australia is, why dress up? Sure, but
They do it in costume. What do you do?
But it's already shot like just 20,000 zombies in the street. My only criticism there was you have to tell people that you're going to do that. So that, let's say, hypothetically, a comedian does not come to Minneapolis for one evening, walk out of his hotel, and then shit himself. Just a little bit of actual shit. As he thinks he's walked into a real-life episode of The Walking Dead. A scenario which I never thought I would thrive. The greatest thing I've ever seen in my life, it happened in America though, and I think if this should be their new flag in many ways, other than the very idea of suggesting a different flag is so profoundly offensive to them, they'd already have finished listening to me. The greatest thing I ever saw was in an airport in America, and there was an old couple, they were like 90 or something, old, worthy of the term old. They had not died for a minimum of 9 decades. And they were holding hands and walking like carefully through the airport, and I was just watching them to check they were okay. And they eventually got to their gate and they sat down and they were out of breath, and I just sat nearby just to monitor the situation. And then, I swear this is true, the wife turned to her husband and she said, "Do you have my glasses, sweetheart? Do you have my glasses, my love? I think they were in your jacket pocket. And could you give me my glasses, please, my sweet?" And he did. I promise you this is true. He did this. He went. And they both burst out laughing. And I think that is the single greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. That's the most romantic gesture I've ever. Dirty Dancing is dead to me now. Because nobody puts baby in the corner has nothing over a nonagenarian bird flip in a deserted airport. America is one of the best things about it as a country is, you know, it is a country of deep faith. They believe in things. And I know that you don't. Look, Australia's like, you've got a what's it coming up, right? A census. Spoiler alert, you have a census. I'm sorry, I didn't realise that was meant to be a surprise. Or whether the Border Patrol are trying to trim some of those branches before the census starts. But there's not many Australians are particularly religious anymore. The same is true in England. That's not the case in America. They believe in things a lot. They have a huge capacity for belief, whether it's religion or anything else. They believe in things, and then those things either happen, in which case they were right, or they don't happen, and they believe they're going to happen anyway. And you just can't argue with that kind of faith. That's bulletproof. It's their capacity for belief is so extreme that there was a documentary last year on the Discovery Channel about mermaids. And it caused a national fucking panic. So much so that there was an official statement released the next day by the US National Oceanographic Administration. We said, mermaids are not real. That's an official government response to their phone lines being jammed by people terrified about not just the existence, but the threat of mermaids. But it wasn't enough to pacify them, so later that day, they released another statement saying, no evidence of aquatic humanoids has ever been found. And let's pause for a moment and agree that if you ever find yourself using the term aquatic humanoids, you've done so very well in your life. And there is a 7-year-old version of yourself that would like to give you a big hug. But even that did not quell the panicked phone calls about this influx of terror mermaids. So there was a final statement released by, and this is true, the US Immigration Agency.
say it's not our agency's position to judge whether or not mermaids exist or don't exist. Our agency has no open investigations into any issues regarding mermaids. Just trust people to hear a story about mermaids and just instinctively make it an immigration issue. They swim over here eating our kelp. They should grow legs and learn to speak English, just like I had to. I can only imagine what Tony Abbott would do with a mermaid panic on his hands. We'll stop those mermaid boats. We'll give them money, say we didn't, and turn them around. There was 60% of the American people say that they've heard the voice of God. See, don't laugh at them. Just, they haven't. You might be right. You might be right, because it's not clear of that 60% how many people are mistaking the voice of God for the voice of Morgan Freeman. We've all made that mistake. Every one of us has made that mistake at least once in our lives. We've all fallen asleep on the couch with the TV on and woken up in a panic going, what's that, Lord? The penguins went where? I believe. Did they march, Lord? Did they, Lord? Praise be. Praise be. Yeah, shitty, but awesome. We did, on the show I do, we set up a religion on the channel. We'll see how much trouble we get in. I'm guessing it's not going to be no trouble. There was someone left me a dollar here backstage. And even better yesterday, and then even better was today. Fuck, I can't. I wish I could project this to show you. We've been getting a lot of weird shit through the mail. And where is it? Someone sent us. I cannot even begin to imagine how much this cost to send. Someone sent us, you can't see it. It's a gigantic wooden penis. with a sign stuck on it saying, rub this and you will get my seed. It's the closest I've ever felt to God, looking at that, thinking, we can do great things together. That's our intern looking like she doesn't want to work in television. This is not what I was told it would be like. Bit of fun, isn't it? It's just a bit of fun. Oh shit, okay. Okay. So, as we wrap this up, praise be. I think the best human quality, and the one that's been probably the most inspirational to me of my life, is defiance. And, you know, I think that's why I feel more at home in America than I thought I would, because, you know, they're defiant in the face of everything, from a threat to a fact. They don't let things push them around. They don't let a fact tell them what it is. They'll be the judge of that. And I admire that kind of confidence, because it's not a confidence that I personally have. Defiance has always been the most inspirational quality. I had this terrible summer job once when I was like 14. I had this summer job in the freezer section of an abattoir. Yes, it was not a great job. But for a while, it was all that I could get. And so what I did is we were kind of taking the frozen meat and just like throwing it down the conveyor belt into something, and it was taken away. But the whole point was, you didn't need to know the intricacies. Not that that was particularly intricate. We threw a thing and it went into another thing, and then eventually it went into a mouth. I saw an adult, a 40-year-old male, defiant in the face of everything that I'd been told an adult was supposed to behave like. Because I saw an adult attempt to steal an entire cow. An entire frozen cow, and it was just magnificent. He climbed inside the frozen ribcage
of the cow, and he made us tape it around his body. And I remember taping it around him. And it was the first time I choked on my own laughter. So I remember thinking, if this is what being a grown-up's going to be like, I think everything's going to be okay. Because this is something I feel I can do. He made us tape the cow's frozen legs to his arms and legs, and then help us pull on this ski suit, oversized ski suit over the top of it, in the summertime. And he shuffled out towards security, leaving a trail of water and blood behind him, like some kind of menstruating snail. And I remember the looks on the faces of the security guards, and they just said, "Gary, just go home and don't do this again. Just go, Gary, but strike one is also strike three." We were pressed up, watching him, like Victorian orphans against the glass. We were watching him go out towards the car park and then bleep his car unlocked before realising in no way was he going to fit inside his car anymore. So he just bleeped it locked again and just walked straight out into the middle of the road, forcing cars to swerve around him. And the last thing I saw him do was this. And I thought, I'm going to remember that. And that memory has been there for me in some troubled times. But the most defiant, again, this is where America really came into its own, because the most, we want to test the mettle of a nation is how do they respond to a natural disaster. And I was in a hurricane for the first time. I've never been in a hurricane before. We don't have hurricanes, obviously, in England. We don't have extreme weather of any kind. We just have a kind of sad air. Just what pushes down on your chest. Just pulls out joy. And pushes in kind of, what? Again, I need a translator. What did you say? I just want to, the gentleman down the front, who literally should be placed on my shoulder, just said, "Don't respond to the idiots at the back." My better conscience is sitting in the front row. Don't blow yourself to a job. You're getting together a big finish. Don't let them do it. This is, you're picking a fight you can't win, John. We live with them. I don't know who they are individually, but I know what we're dealing with up there. You don't fight it, you learn to live with it. Yes. You hope one day Luna Park will take them. The point is, there was Hurricane Sandy hit New York, the biggest hurricane to hit the city on record, and it was devastating. And you know, I was watching, I felt completely out of control, and the trees getting pulled up outside my apartment, and I was turned on the local news, and there was this journalist, they'd evacuated Lower Manhattan. There was this journalist standing in front of New York Harbor with the Statue of Liberty in the background. He was just getting battered by the wind, and he said, "If you've not left the evacuation area, you need to do so immediately. This situation is dangerous and it is deteriorating by the second." And I thought, I don't feel in control. I don't think this is going to end well. And then, out of nowhere, again, you have to believe me, this is true. Just over the journalist's shoulder, out in the water, burst a guy on a jet ski. Bouncing off the waves so high, I honestly thought at one point he was going to try and high-five the Statue of Liberty. And to his credit, the cameraman panned straight off the journalist onto the guy on the jet ski. He didn't have to do that. Technically, he shouldn't have done it, but he knew what the right action was in that moment. You could feel him thinking, "I know what you're saying, but I have no idea what he's doing. I refuse to be the only witness to this. You asked me to carry too much." And then the jet ski stopped all of a sudden. I thought, oh no, he's jet skied too hard. And now we might all be forced to witness a tragedy. But I should have believed in him as much as he believed in himself and the eccentric country to which he proudly belongs. Because his jet ski was fine, Melbourne. It was fine. He just turned it off for a second so he could take out a stick on the end of which he placed a camera so he could take a photo of himself on a jet ski in front of the Statue of Liberty with a fucking hurricane in the background. That is one hell of a selfie. Melbourne, thank you so much for coming out.